The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine, dated September 7th, 2012. We'll begin, as always, with the main story section of The Week magazine. And this week, the first article is entitled, "The GOP's Effort to Warm Voters to Romney." The Republican Party crowned Mitt Romney as its presidential nominee this past week, using its national convention in Tampa to reintroduce the candidate as a warm-hearted problem solver committed to helping his family, his church, and his country. The centerpiece of the party's efforts to humanize Romney was a speech by his wife, Ann, who testified to his steadfast nature. "You can trust Mitt," she said. "This man will not fail. This man will not let us down. This man will lift up America." Romney's campaign is keenly aware that many voters still view the wealthy venture capitalist as stiff and remote and have yet to warm to him personally. A poll this week found that only 31% of voters viewed him favorably, 23 points lower than President Obama. "I know there are some people who do a very good job acting and pretend they're something that they're not," Romney said this week. "I am who I am." His own speech to the delegates came just after the week went to press. The GOP also highlighted the poor state of the economy with a parade of speakers emphasizing the ballooning deficit and criticizing what they see as President Obama's hostility to the business community. A national debt clock was installed in the arena, and an entire evening of speeches was dedicated to mocking Obama's comment, "If you've got a successful business, you didn't build that," which Democrats say was taken out of context. Now here's what the editorials had to say. "This election is still incredibly close," said the Washington Examiner, with new polls showing Obama and Romney essentially tied. And while party conventions rarely make a big impact on a presidential race, they do allow the party's leading candidates to introduce themselves to the electorate and hone their campaign message. "Republicans delivered in spades," said the New York Post, "by daring to tell voters that the country is headed off a fiscal cliff of runaway spending. Unlike Democrats, the GOP has the courage to speak the hard truths and treat Americans as adults." Hard truths? Rarely has a national political convention relied so heavily on truth-twisting, distortions, and plain falsehoods, said the New York Times. The keynote speaker, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, failed to mention that his own clumsy budget slashing has resulted in a higher unemployment rate than when he took over. Rick Santorum, meanwhile, simply parroted Romney's blatantly false advertising about how Obama has gutted the work requirement for welfare. Now here's what the columnist said. "Finally, Republicans have fallen in love with a Romney," said David Frum in the DailyBeast.com. The prospective First Lady's warm and charming homily to her husband succeeded in emphasizing Romney's unwavering reliability and won her a standing ovation. She also tried to counteract the Democrats' war on women storyline, said Rebecca Metzler in USNews.com. "By emphasizing that the economy has a major impact on moms and grandmothers who," she said, "always have to do a little more," her attempt to forge a bond with women voters was naked but effective. It wasn't effective to women who don't share her privileged perch, said Alec McGillis in TNR.com. Behind Ann Romney's perfect smile, ordinary women can detect a hardness and not always suppressed self-satisfaction about her family's enormous wealth. Sure, Mitt loves his wife and his family, but where is the evidence that he gives a damn about the rest of us? What voters need is competence, not good intentions, said Steve Huntley in the Chicago Sun-Times. Romney has succeeded in everything he's done in public and private life, including saving the Salt Lake City Olympics. Behind his facade of niceness, Obama has no new ideas, only a record of failure. Yes, likability is a silly metric with which to judge prospective presidents, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. But Americans have a strangely intimate relationship with their president, given that we spend 4 years with him in our living rooms. Romney will never get voters to swoon for him, but to win over the few remaining swing voters, crossing the threshold of minimum likability remains his biggest challenge. Our next article from the main story section of the week, a muted battering from Hurricane Isaac. New Orleans' strengthened defenses withstood a battering by Hurricane Isaac, whose fierce winds and torrential rains caused serious flooding through the Gulf Coast this past week, but did not devastate the city as Hurricane Katrina had 7 years ago. The slow-moving Category 1 hurricane, later downgraded to a tropical storm, lumbered ashore in southeastern Louisiana late Tuesday, with 80-mile-an-hour winds knocking out power to more than 725,000 homes and businesses across the coast. Earlier in the week, the storm battered the Caribbean, killing 29 people in Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and pummeled South Florida with winds and heavy rain, prompting Republicans to cancel the first day of their national convention in Tampa. In New Orleans, many residents chose to hunker down rather than evacuate, thanks to Isaac's relative weakness and a $14.5 billion ring of levees built since Katrina. There was no repeat of the catastrophe that occurred in 2005, when 80% of the city was left underwater and 1,800 people died. "Your city is secured," said Mayor Mitch Landrieu. "We dodged a bullet." Now here's what the editorials had to say. Isaac's landfall, while we're raw with Katrina memories, was another emotional wallop we would have preferred to live without, said the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Though this storm isn't in the same league as Katrina, which hit land with winds of up to 125 miles per hour, no one is eager to see our upgraded levee system put to the test. Our city has stubbornly rekindled its indomitable spirit since Katrina, but we can't help but feel some anxiety that another disaster could upend our lives again. Isaac's winds are a reminder of the necessity of government, its labor, its expertise, its money in times of crisis, said the New York Times. If only someone would tell the Republicans in Tampa. As part of their simplistic promises about the power of slashing government spending, House Republicans have cut FEMA grants for a disaster preparedness by 43% over the past 2 years, leaving first responders and citizens less prepared for future hurricanes, tornadoes, and floods. Now here's what the columnist said. Now those same Republicans who decry the size of government are lined up for federal aid, said Susan Milligan in the USNews.com. They conveniently forget that private industry won't step in and save people from drowning or help them rebuild their homes without promise of a profit. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, who has pilloried President Obama over federal spending, had the gall this past week to attack him for not giving his state more funds, said Katrina VandenHeuvel in the Washington Post. Hurricanes, it seems, can sober the most besotted ideologues. At least New Orleans was ready, said Kathy Finn in Reuters.com. Its new world-class flood defense system, built by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, offers a 350-mile network of enormous pumps, floodgates, and earthworks to protect the city from the disastrous flooding that followed Katrina. One of the most impressive improvements is the $1 billion-plus, 2-mile, 26-foot-high wall, the largest of its kind in the world. That blocks storm surges from Lake Borgne on the eastern side of the city, said Christopher Hellman in Forbes.com. The Corps has also installed the world's largest water pump, capable of sucking 150,000 gallons per second out of the below-sea-level bowl that New Orleans lives in. The city's residents were much better prepared than they were before Katrina. Yet they remain dangerously exposed to the next big storm, said John Barry in the DailyBeast.com. The Crescent City's new levee system sounds like good protection. It isn't. It is designed to protect the city against a so-called 100-year storm. But in the last 85 years alone, the lower Mississippi saw at least 4 floods bigger than the 100-year worst-case scenario. What Louisiana really needs is to rebuild its protective coast, which disappears at the rate of a football field every 50 minutes. Reversing that wouldn't be cheap or quick, but shielding coastal cities from storms is something the country can't afford not to do. Now we'll turn to the controversy of the week in the Week magazine. It's entitled, Lance Armstrong, Does Cheating Destroy His Legacy? In his quest to be the greatest cyclist ever, Lance Armstrong let nothing stop him, said the Chicago Tribune in an editorial. Not testicular cancer, which spread to his brain and lungs and left him with a 50% chance of survival. Not the grueling alpine climbs of the Tour de France, which he won a record 7 times. But after the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency accused him of systematically cheating to gain an edge, the combative Texan did something last week he had never done before. He gave up. Armstrong still insists he never doped, calling the USADA investigation a witch hunt, said the New York Daily News. But his surrender was an implicit admission of guilt. The USADA says its review of old blood tests found overwhelming proof that Armstrong used steroids and the banned red blood cell boosting substance EPO, and illegally gave himself blood transfusions during races to increase his endurance. 10 former teammates were prepared to testify that Armstrong was at the center of a sophisticated blood doping scheme designed to evade detection. Knowing the evidence against him was strong, Armstrong elected not to fight any further. The hill was too steep. There's still no evidence of Armstrong's guilt, said Greg Lott in BleacherReport.com. Throughout his 20-year career, jealous rivals have consistently tried to label him a cheat and sully his impeccable reputation. Anti-doping authorities have subjected him to hundreds of drug tests, none of which he ever failed. After realizing the futility of fighting an Orwellian agency with an obvious vendetta, Armstrong has simply stepped out of the arena. Nonetheless, his unparalleled legacy stands. He'll always be remembered as the cancer survivor who rose from his deathbed to become the greatest cyclist of his or any other generation, and raised $500 million to support other cancer survivors through his Livestrong charity. And if he did take enhancers, so what, said Buzz Bissinger in Newsweek. Professional cycling is a rotten sport, and every rider who finished second to Armstrong in the Tour has since been connected to doping. If Armstrong used banned substances, he was merely leveling the playing field. He was still the one who overcame all odds. Your loyalty is misplaced, said Rick Morrissey in the Chicago Sun-Times. Yes, Armstrong's charity has helped many cancer victims, but the man also has a massive ego, cheated to win races, and then lied about it repeatedly to protect his brand, which has made him a very wealthy man. Now he's decided to play the martyr role, figuring his cancer work and blind hero worship will shield him. Sorry, Armstrong fans, you have been cheering for a hollow man. Why must it be either or, said Mary Schmick in the Chicago Tribune. If Armstrong cheated at cycling, does it change the fact that his astonishing comeback from cancer and the survivor network he created inspired so many people in their own fight to live? People can still do a lot of good, even if they're not full-fledged heroes. Amen to that, said Kurt Badenhausen in Forbes.com. 5 years ago, Armstrong's book and example helped me keep my spirits up through a brutal year-long course of radiation and chemotherapy for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I even began competing in triathlons as a tribute to him. There are thousands of cancer survivors who got through some very dark moments because of what he symbolized. That is more important than the tour medals, and that is why Lance Armstrong still matters. And now we'll turn to the popular column in the Week magazine called A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for Bessie Cooper of Monroe, Georgia, who celebrated her 116th birthday. I mind my own business and I don't eat junk food, said Cooper, believed to be the world's oldest living person. It was a good week for a tooth after Nepali farmer Mohammed Salmadin bit a cobra to death after it bit him first. A snake charmer told me that if a snake bites you, bite it until it is dead and nothing will happen to you, explained Salmadin, who survived his bite. Will.i.am, that was a good week for him, Will.i.am, after the hip-hop artist's new single, Reach for the Stars, was downloaded to NASA's Curiosity rover and beamed back to a group of school children on Earth, the first song ever broadcast from another planet. It was a bad week for driving in Washington, D.C., after a national insurance study ranked motorists there the most accident-prone in the nation. Drivers there have an accident every 4.8 years, compared with every 13.8 years in the safest city, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. It was a bad week for amateur beekeeping after police and professional beekeepers confiscated 3 million bees from a home in Queens, New York. Yai Jen Chin had 45 hives packed into his backyard, and the swarms terrified neighbors. It's gotten out of hand, he acknowledged. And it was a bad week for Richard Eggers, who is 68 years old, who was fired by a Wells Fargo bank in Des Moines when a background check found that he'd been arrested in 1963 for putting a fake dime into a laundromat washing machine. It was a stupid stunt, Eggers said, but I don't think that it warrants a termination almost a half century later. Now we'll turn to the People's section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first item is called Lundgren's Tough Act. Dolph Lundgren wasn't always so imposing, said Marlo Stern in the DailyBeast.com. The 6'5" actor who played Soviet boxer Ivan Drago in Rocky IV grew up as a skinny kid in a suburb of Stockholm. His father beat him regularly. He was violent toward my mom and me, says the action movie star. So I got into martial arts to work out my anger. Lundgren won the European Championships in karate in 1980 and 1981. The following year, he was awarded a Fulbright scholarship to MIT, but he lost interest in school when he was hired as a bodyguard by singer Grace Jones. He became her lover, and she got him into acting, modeling, and all that stuff. But after Rocky IV, his movie career bombed. Not that Lundgren cared. I never put 100% into it. I wanted my kids to grow up away from Hollywood. So I lived in Marbella, Spain for 10 years. Still, his reputation as a Hollywood bad guy had its benefits. In 2009, while Lundgren was off shooting a film, a group of masked men burst into his home and took his family hostage. Lundgren says that when his oldest daughter screamed, "If my dad was here, this would be different," the men looked at a family photograph and quickly fled. "I wanted to get these guys and kill them slowly, but I couldn't find them." The next article is The Reclusive Marlboro Man. In the 1950s, William Thurlby looked out from billboards and invited smokers to Marlboro country, said Corey Kilgannon in the New York Times. "I'm the original Marlboro man," says the 88-year-old former actor and model. "But I never smoked or drank, and I was no cowboy." For the past few decades, Thurlby has lived alone in a small room at the New York Athletic Club, surrounded by reminders of his star-studded career. He appeared with James Mansfield on Broadway and with Frank Sinatra in The Manchurian Candidate. And he once co-owned a restaurant with legendary athlete and Olympian Jim Thorpe. "Jim adopted me as his son in an Indian ceremony. I called him Dad, and he called me my boy." His most famous role came in 1953 when he was sent on a casting call for Marlboro cigarettes. He posed bare-chested with a cowboy hat and received a one-off fee of $300. "One day I'm walking out of rehearsals for a Broadway play, and I see a truck go by with my face on it. I couldn't believe it." After a life lived in the spotlight, Thurlby now seems content with his own company. "People come over to me at the club and ask to sit down, but I've always been a loner," he says. And the next article from the People section is Perry's Work Ethic. "Katy Perry won't slow down for anyone," said Mickey Rapkin in Elle. While the pop singer was on tour last year, her marriage to British comedian Russell Brand started to fall apart. But she refused to let the heartbreak affect her live show. "There were times when I would be bent over crying before I went on stage," says Perry, who is 27 years old. "But I'd suck it up because my pain is my pain. I had 120 people on tour with me, and I needed to keep everybody moving forward." The singer has always shown a single-minded focus when it comes to her career. The daughter of poor Christian ministers in Santa Barbara, California, she decided at age 9 that music would be her path out of poverty. "We didn't have any money. Have you ever heard of the food bank? That's where we got all our food." At 15, Perry moved to Nashville by herself to pursue her dream, and 2 years later was signed to a major record label. Tabloid columnists have speculated that her workaholic lifestyle, she oversees everything from concert costumes to song lyrics, caused her marriage to collapse. But Perry has no regrets. "I love what I do, and when I don't, I'll make a change." Now, from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the briefing section. Our article this week is entitled "A Virtual Princeton." Elite universities are throwing open their classroom doors to anyone with an internet connection for free. Why are colleges offering free classes? They don't want to be left behind in the digital revolution that has already transformed the way we consume news, music, and books. Stanford, Duke, Princeton, and Johns Hopkins are among the 16 universities that have partnered with a newly launched company called Coursera to offer more than 100 free online courses this academic year. MIT, Harvard, and the University of California, Berkeley are following suit through a nonprofit venture called EDX. Now people anywhere in the world can take Stanford's Introduction to Mathematical Thinking, learn the principles of obesity economics at Johns Hopkins, or have Duke University behavioral economist Dan Ariely lead them through a beginner's guide to irrational behavior, all without paying the $50,000 usually required to attend these world-class universities. More than 1 million people from scores of countries have already enrolled in the free classes, which some believe could transform the mission and model of higher education. Anant Agarwal, president of EDX, calls it the single biggest change in education since the printing press. What's in it for colleges? Prestige now and possibly profit later. Schools say they're willing to give their product away for free so they don't miss the chance to be among the first to develop new forms of education. The potential upside for this experiment is so big that it's hard for me to imagine any large research university that wouldn't want to be involved, said Richard DeMillo, director of the Center for 21st Century Universities at Georgia Tech. One day the schools will likely try to make some money, too, possibly by charging students for credits or allowing companies to sponsor courses. But universities recognize that they could be jeopardizing their hard-won reputations and their time-tested business model, said Jason Weingard, a vice dean of the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. You run the risk of potentially diluting your brand. Well, how do these classes work? Much like a typical college lecture course, but with an audience in the tens or even hundreds of thousands. At a time of their choosing, students watch videos of lectures by respected professors and complete interactive quizzes and regular homework to prove they grasp the material. The web videos incorporate graphics and virtual games, and students can pose questions and debate one another in online discussion groups. Professors say it's thrilling to reach so many students at once, from teenagers in India to baby boomers in Indiana. Coursera co-founder Andrew Ng, a Stanford computer science professor, recently taught an online class to more than 100,000 students. To reach that many people, Ng said, I would have had to teach my normal Stanford class for 250 years. Are the classes effective? Some educators doubt that virtual classes can match the experience of face-to-face learning. Online education tends to be a monologue and not a real dialogue, said University of Virginia English professor Mark Edmondson. There's also an extremely high attrition rate. Of the 160,000 people who enrolled in a Stanford artificial intelligence course last year, only 23,000 finished the work. But the feedback that could improve these courses is just beginning to roll in, and there's already some evidence that students who stick with online courses learn just as much as those in conventional classes. This is the Wild West, said Agarwal. There's a lot of things we have to figure out. Will this trend make college cheaper? There are grounds for hope. Since 1985, U.S. college tuition rates and fees have grown by 559%. In theory, online courses could cut costs by enabling universities to outsource coursework to the Internet and do away with or share some academic departments. Fewer students would need campus housing and other services. Universities have so far opposed giving credit for free classes instead of conferring certificates that don't count toward a degree. But that's already starting to change, with the University of Washington offering credit for Coursera classes this fall. Could the web replace universities? Not anytime soon. Why do people pay $50,000 a year to attend an institution like Caltech, Ng said. The real value is the interactions with professors and other equally bright students. Still, even a remote dose of elite education can have great value to students who have no chance of setting foot on an Ivy League campus. And lessons drawn from the courses could reshape how colleges approach teaching, turning the ability to offer a mix of online and face-to-face learning into the new gold standard for top-notch educators. Sebastian Thrun, a Stanford research professor who offers free online computer science classes, predicts that there will be only 10 higher education institutions in the world in 50 years. It's pretty obvious that degrees will go away, he said. The idea of a degree is that you spend a fixed time right after high school to educate yourself for the rest of your career. But careers change so much over a lifetime that this model isn't valid it anymore. In the future, he says, people will return to college throughout their lives, updating what they know through online courses. And the footnote to this particular briefing article is entitled, A Fresh Start for the Jobless. Free online courses might have millions of immediate beneficiaries among unemployed workers who need job retraining. Even with a law degree from the University of Chicago, Dennis Callahan, 29, couldn't get hired. But after taking several free Stanford courses in building databases, he recently landed a job as a programmer for a media website. And now he is planning to work his way through Coursera classes in his spare time until he's earned the equivalent of a BA in computer science from Stanford, he told the Fast Company. Andy Rice, who owns a weather forecasting company in Minnesota, says he's heartened when he sees resumes from job applicants listing free courses. I definitely want to hire people who are always questing for new knowledge, he said. Life's not about what you learn when you are 22 years old. And you are listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for this week. Thanks so much for joining me today. We'll now turn to the best columns in the U.S., according to the editors of the Week magazine. The first one is entitled The Value of Political Conventions by Connie Cass in the Associated Press. Why do Republicans and Democrats still stage political conventions? Every 4 years, said Connie Cass, a chorus of critics call for an end to these contrived, made-for-TV extravaganzas, especially since their original purpose, picking party nominees, was long ago moved to the more democratic process of primaries and caucuses. But as boring and predictable as the conventions have become, they are not without value. 4 years after the last election, they serve as a national stock-taking, a debate on how we're doing, and a glimpse into the future. It was at the conventions, after all, that we had our very first early glimpses of Ronald Reagan, Barack Obama, and Bill Clinton. On the grand stage, we saw Geraldine Ferraro, Sarah Palin, and Hillary Clinton bursting through doors once locked to them. Each convention serves as a Rorschach test of what's on our minds. This year, it's joblessness, gay marriage, religious freedom, the national debt, and women's rights. Each party's best speakers have a chance to break through the noise and say something in a way that sticks in the national consciousness. Can't we spare a few days for that? The next column here is entitled, Are Chemicals a Factor in Autism? And this was written by Nicholas D. Kristof in the New York Times. 9 out of 10 Americans have a chemical called bisphenol A in their urine, said Nicholas Kristof. BPA, which can be found in plastic, food containers, soup can linings, ATM receipts, and many other consumer products, is a proven endocrine disruptor, a substance that mimics or alters human hormones. Studies have already linked BPA to breast cancer, diabetes, and hyperactivity, and now a new study in the journal Endocrinology suggests a link to autism and attention deficit disorder. The researchers found that BPA seemed to interfere with hormones like oxytocin and vasopressin, which affect trust and bonding. Mice exposed to dosages analogous to typical human exposure began acting like autistic kids. Their antisocial behavior, moreover, was passed down to the next 3 generations of mice. Like Big Tobacco a generation ago, Big Chem has decided there's any health hazard in the hundreds of chemicals it's introduced into our bodies. But serious scientists are finding evidence that BPA may be even more harmful than previously thought. Isn't it time we started to pay attention? And our third column from the Week magazine this week is Denying the Obvious at the Times. And this was written by Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Here's a shocking news flash from the New York Times, said Jonathan S. Tobin. The New York Times suffers from liberal bias. This assessment comes to us courtesy of Arthur Brisbane, the Gray Lady's public editor, in the final column of his two-year tenure assessing the newspaper's coverage. Brisbane lauded the professionalism of the Times editors and reporters and said that in covering political campaigns, they are disciplined about enforcing fairness and balance, his words. But he said the worldview within the Times is powerfully shaped by a culture of like minds that embrace political and cultural progressivism as the only sane and decent option. As a direct result, Brisbane said the paper has displayed a giddy enthusiasm for gay marriage, the Occupy Wall Street movement, and other progressive causes in its news coverage. Well, duh. Nonetheless, the paper's executive editor, Jill Abramson, publicly disputed even Brisbane's rather mild conclusions, insisting that the Times coverage is always straight. Sure, the executive editor's blinkered denial of what is obvious to everyone tells us all that we needed to know about the smug, self-satisfied culture of the New York Times. Now we will flip to the back of the magazine to the last word. And this particular week, the article is entitled Back to 1968. You've heard of reenacting the Civil War. Charlie Schroeder found a group that refights the war in Vietnam. It was the start of a sweltering August morning in a remote and wooded part of Virginia. Inside a large general-purpose military tent, I rolled off my period authentic air mattress and headed toward the woods for a quick pee. Then I felt something catch my right boot, looked down and saw a piece of fishing line about 4 inches off the ground that stretched along the tent's perimeter. I followed it until it terminated at a party popper noisemaker. I was a dead man. Overnight, a Viet Cong had stolen into our camp and set a tripwire inches from my head. If this were the real war and not a reenactment, I'd have been sent home in a body bag. Perhaps I should have known. I'd spent the better part of the past 10 months embedded with a series of historical reenactment groups in an effort to learn about history and one of America's quirkiest hobbies. To most Americans, the word reenactor conjures up images of overweight, middle-aged white guys bivouacking among the hills of Gettysburg. And there's good reason for this. The Civil War is by far the most popular war to reenact, with an estimated 50,000 people regularly kitting up in the blue or gray. It was also the first war to be reenacted in America. From its modest beginning at the war's centennial celebrations, the modern reenactment era was born. The Civil War, however, is just one of many conflicts Americans revive. I've met people who dress up as soldiers from ancient Greece and Rome. I've seen Vikings and Revolutionary War soldiers. But no time period provokes as strong a reaction as the fringe of the fringe hobby of reenacting the war in Vietnam. On more than a few occasions, reenactors I met expressed their dismay to learn that people would want to reenact their generation's most polarizing conflict. As one French and Indian War reenactor told me, Vietnam isn't history, it's reality. I've been invited to do the NAM by Patrick Hubble, a kind, soft-spoken mortician from Lynchburg, Virginia. When he arrived at base camp on a muggy afternoon, I volunteered to be a radio telephone operator, an RTO, thinking that I'd be able to put to use some of my skills as a contributor to NPR, which is National Public Radio. But I soon realized that being an operator involved carrying a 25-pound brick on my back. a guy named Buck, who wore a straw fedora and thick black glasses, briefed me on how to operate it. Then he handed me a topographical map with Vietnamese village names on it and an index card-sized cheat sheet with military codes and squad names like Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, and Bulldog, Hellcat, and Foxhound. There's a strong possibility that the slopes have radios, he told me while demonstrating how to dial in the right frequency. We know the dinks are going to listen. I hadn't heard racial epithets tossed off so casually since John McCain called his Vietnamese prison guards gooks during the 2000 presidential campaign. I asked Buck what my duties were. You're going to hump that thing and be up Sergeant Miller's anus, he replied. For a moment, I considered all that would entail, then quickly tried to block it out. I grabbed one of the radio's shoulder straps and started to pick it up. It barely budged. After breakfast the next morning, with the sun so low it hardly penetrated the wooded surroundings, I marched behind Sergeant Miller on a dirt road. About 10 other squad members followed me. After only 100 yards, I saw a quick flash of fire, followed by an incredibly loud blast. It was the loudest gunshot I'd ever heard. He hung a sharp right into the woods. In the distance, startled dogs howled. Saddled with over 30 pounds of equipment, I could barely clear fallen trees, and the radio's 10-foot metal antenna often got caught on limbs and thwopped whomever I was near. After about 10 minutes of trudging through thick growth, we heard an exchange of loud and prolonged gunfire. Another squad was engaging the enemy. Sergeant Miller, who, like Buck, wore thick black glasses, looked at me, pointed two fingers at his eyes, then pointed into the distance. I started to get up, but the radio was so heavy it pulled me back down. I quickly grabbed hold of a tree to stay upright. Then a tinny voice from inside my jacket asked, "What are your coordinates? Over." This was my big chance. I pulled out the receiver and pressed the call button. "This is Charlie," I whispered. "Did you say Charlie? Over." I realized that I'd told him that I was the enemy, the Viet Cong, Victor Charlie. This is. I couldn't remember our squad's code name, so I dug out my cheat sheet. "Rum Punch 2 here," I whispered. "Over." "Rum Punch 2, this is Rum Punch 1. What are your coordinates? Over." I looked around, but all I saw were trees, leaves, and a handful of aging GIs crouching down to avoid detection. I consulted the topographical map, rings of squiggly circles and elevation points labeled 30, 50, and 40. "I think we're to the right of everybody," I said. "Where do they want us to go?" Sergeant Miller asked. I shrugged. He grabbed the receiver and started talking in code. "The village," he said. Full immersion tacticals like this one always take place on private property, far from the public's gaze. The intent, as organizers will tell you, is to give participants a period rush, or rather, as you were there, experience. In two of my previous engagements on private land, reenacting the Battle of Stalingrad and Rome's first century invasion of Britannia, we were often told that misery was part of the fun. As a German general put it, "When it sucks, and I promise you it will, remember that's why you came." As we lumbered ahead a few hundred yards, it wasn't yet clear how miserable I'd soon feel. Ahead in a clearing, I saw an older white guy dressed head to toe in black pajamas, wearing a coolie hat, and fiddling with a rake outside a hooch. He looked right at us, 10 GIs, weapons drawn, but didn't change his expression. Past him in the village, a small cluster of bamboo and wooden hooches, more Vietnamese villagers tilled the land. "Ba Toc Cam," one villager said in an imitation Vietnamese. "Tuk Lung Bok," another answered. I felt as if I just landed in a surreal George Saunders story, or Platoon. Soon another squad of 10 soldiers joined us. "Keep your eyes peeled for any booby traps," said the sergeant, a thick 30-something in rectangular glasses named Ewing. I lumbered into the village and felt a wave of discomfort wash over me. Part of it was empathy, just what it was like for a 20-year-old GI from Iowa to be in a mysterious country. Not knowing if that guy over there was a villager or a Viet Cong about to kill him, but the other part was just how strange it all felt. "Sarge, this bunker's seriously jacked," one of the GIs said. He was standing next to a small pit. "Permission to blow it?" "Not yet," Ewing ordered. Another GI rifled through a bamboo hut, searching for weapons. "There's a shit ton of ammo over here, Sarge." "Fricking goddamn arsenal." "All right, make sure none of them have any weapons," he said. One grunt, a dead ringer for Joey on Friends, whom I'll call LeBlanc, quickly rounded up a handful of villagers. LeBlanc grabbed their hoes and rakes from them. "Where are the weapons, gook? Ha!" he shouted. "I asked you, where are all the goddamn weapons?" "Bano, baba, bano," a gray-haired Vietnamese answered, sticking his hands in his pockets. "Take your hands out of your pockets, you freaking dink," LeBlanc said, but the guy didn't. "Bon apnatem." LeBlanc yanked the villager's hands out of his pocket. "Keep 'em where I can see 'em," he ordered the villagers to lie on the ground, kick their feet apart, and spread their hands in front of them. Watching all this made me feel sick to my stomach, so I withdrew to the village's perimeter, switched my gun to safety, and leaned up against a tree. Near me, two GIs chatted. My dad said they used to put out cigarettes behind guys' ears to get them to talk, one of them said, chuckling. "Sarge, this gook is wearing GI boots," LeBlanc said, then held up his wrist. "And a GI watch." The villager remained face first on the ground, expressionless. "You know what we do to gooks that we find wearing GI fatigues?" LeBlanc asked. Another soldier lifted the villager up by an armpit, walked him toward the opposite end of the village, and forced him to his knees. Then he grabbed his hands and placed them behind his head. "Bap hi lam no," the villager protested loudly. The GI walked 20 feet away, turned, and with one hand on his machine gun, mowed down the villager. I got a period rush, all right. Later at base camp, soldiers cracked cans of PBR and Miller. An old transistor radio blared Jefferson Airplane's White Rabbit. On the drive home, Patrick would tell me and Nam the soldiers would celebrate that they'd lived another day. I'm sure many of the GIs, Iraq and Afghanistan veterans themselves, could identify. Before we reached the highway, Patrick asked me what I thought of the experience. "I found it to be really disturbing," I said. His face was lit up by the dashboard, and I could see out of the corner of my eye that he was disappointed. We didn't talk about it again until early the next morning, while en route to the airport. I told Patrick that I found the repeated use of racial epithets upsetting and that I thought LeBlanc needed help. Patrick listened closely and thought about it for a bit, then suggested that LeBlanc should come before a war crimes trial. Patrick told me that many of the participants were sons of Vietnam vets and that they grew up hearing war stories from their fathers, who'd never forgotten what the enemy did to them and their fellow soldiers. The idea of forgiveness entered our conversation. According to Patrick, many World War II veterans have forgiven the Germans. After all, they were just soldiers following orders, but not the Japanese. Many Vietnam vets will also never forgive their enemy. The Americans worship the same God as Germans. They look like them. They ate similar food, Patrick said. But a lot of the Vietnam vets and the sons, they carry that hatred around, he said. When I got back to Los Angeles, the first thing I did was hug my wife. Then I downloaded White Rabbit. For the next 3 days, I listened to it repeatedly during my work commute. I'd been at fake war for 24 hours, but Vietnam stayed with me. I still can't hear that song without thinking about the jungles of Virginia. And that is from an article called From Man of War by Charlie Schroeder, reprinted by arrangement with Hudson Street Press, a member of the Penguin Group. Now from the Week magazine, we will turn to the Talking Points section here. Our first article is called Abortion: Will Aiken's Rape Blunder Hurt the Republicans. I almost feel sorry for Todd Akin, said Joan Walsh in Salon.com. The Missouri Republican congressman and Senate candidate triggered a national furor last week with his deeply ignorant claim that women cannot be impregnated by rapists because in the case of legitimate rape, women's bodies have ways to shut that whole thing down. Akin's statement not only horrified women, it panicked his fellow Republicans, who knew it would put a spotlight on their alliance with right-wing religious extremists. So they unsuccessfully pleaded with him to withdraw from the Senate race. But in his clumsy way, Akin was just trying to justify what has become mainstream Republican thinking, that abortion should be banned in all circumstances, even in the case of rape or incest. The truth is that Akin is typical of today's GOP, not some outlier, said Frank Rich in NYMag.com. This year's Republican Party platforms calls for the same total abortion ban Akin supports. Paul Ryan, the party's vice presidential candidate, describes himself as being as pro-life as a person gets and has co-sponsored nearly 40 anti-abortion bills in the House. He even joined Akin as a co-sponsor of a personhood bill that nefariously distinguished between forcible rape and other types of rape. Akin is an idiot, said Mark Salter in RealClearPolitics.com, but his notion that rape victims have special birth control powers is his alone, not the Republican Party's. What many pro-life Republicans do believe is that life begins at conception. If you sincerely hold that view, it follows naturally that the unborn children of crime victims deserve protection, even if they were conceived in an awful act of violence. Given the threats facing the country, why are we even arguing about abortion, said Mark Sten in thenationalreview.com. I'll tell you why. Democrats don't want to talk about Obama's broken promises, the stagnant economy, or the ruinous deficit. Hence their phony claim of a GOP war on women and their strenuous efforts to make Akin the face of the Republican Party. It may be hard for a conservative male to understand, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, but abortion rights are not irrelevant to millions of Americans. Voters have noticed a strange contradiction within modern republicanism, which demands limited government that stays out of our business and lets us live our lives, but wants to police every pregnancy in the land. If Romney is elected, said Michael Tomosky in the DailyBeast.com, he's likely to appoint one or more Supreme Court justices, moving the court far to the right. Roe versus Wade may well be overturned, and without Roe, Troglo conservatives like Akin would ban abortion altogether in dozens of states. They might even ban in vitro fertilization and some forms of birth control they contend kill fertilized eggs, such as the pill and IUDs. You want to talk about extremism, said John McCormick in WeeklyStandard.com. From his days as a state senator in Illinois, President Obama has opposed any restriction on abortion, including a law to protect infants who had been born alive during botched late-term abortions, and a ban on abortions for gender selection. His unwavering commitment to abortion on demand puts him way out to the left of the American mainstream. 72% of voters oppose public funding of abortion, and 86% favor third trimester bans. When you compare this with Romney's view that abortion policy should result from democratic processes in Congress and the states, said NationalReview.com in an editorial, it's clear that the Republican nominee's viewpoint is light years closer to the median voter than is Obama's position. Democrats don't seem to realize that James Torontos in WSJ, in their eagerness to Akinize the GOP, the Democrats are planning to put abortion rights at the center of their convention next week, with fiery speeches from such pro-choice absolutists as the heads of Planned Parenthood and the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws. This could backfire. Polls show that most Americans are very conflicted about abortion, with just 25% saying that it should be legal under all circumstances, 52% say it should be legal only under certain circumstances. A heavy focus on abortion may turn off swing voters who just want to know who's got the best plan to fix the economy. Todd Akin's foolishness may doom his own Senate campaign in Missouri, but we doubt it will save Barack Obama. The next article, the middle class and why it's struggling. America's middle class is smaller, poorer, and more pessimistic than at any time in living memory, said Taylor Batten in the Charlotte, North Carolina Observer. A new study by the Pew Research Center found that for households earning between $39,000 and $118,000, the years from 2000 to 2010 were a lost decade, with the median middle class income actually falling. And thanks to the collapse of house prices, the wealth of middle-class families plummeted by 28% over the same period. The Great Recession is one obvious cause, said Henry Blodgett in BusinessInsider.com, but so are the decline in wages caused by globalization, the decline of private sector unions, and companies' wholesale embrace of a shareholder value religion that values profit over everything else. Many companies are reporting record profits, but are refusing to substantially raise salaries. As a result, the middle class no longer has the buying power that once made the U.S. economy the envy of the world. You can blame President Obama for that, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. It's true that the middle class's problems began during the Bush administration when there was subpar economic growth, even before the Great Recession hit and cut median incomes by 2.9%. But incomes have sunk another 4.8% since the recession ended in June 2009, meaning the Obama recovery has been worse than the Bush recession. That does amount to a stunningly bad economic record for an incumbent president to run on, said Timothy Noah in the New Republic. Yet Obama remains the slight favorite to win. Why? The Romney-Ryan ticket is uniquely terrible, with its blatant emphasis on putting even more money into the pockets of the rich. The reality is that neither Obama nor Romney can do much to aid the middle class, said Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post. What's needed is a vibrant economic recovery, but the recovery will remain glacial until consumers regain confidence and start spending vigorously. Consumers, though, are still paying down all the household debt they ran up on credit cards and mortgages before the housing bubble in 2008. It'll take years for that process to unwind. The good news is that thanks to personal responsibility and a strong work ethic, the middle class is headed back in the right direction. It's those durable values and not any presidential magic trick that ensure it will survive. And now, as we close our program, let's take a look at the poll watch for this week. 94% of African Americans say they will vote for President Obama in November. 0% say they'll vote for Mitt Romney. Obama also leads Romney among Latino voters by a 2-to-1 margin, and among women, 51% to 41%. Romney has a big edge among whites, 53% to 40%. And 52% of obese Americans say they've been discriminated against when applying for a job or a promotion. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long, until next time.